I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The tax overhaul will bring lower rates and other benefits to corporations and the super rich. But my guest today says that with all the attention being paid to the top 1% of the wealthiest Americans, we shouldn't let the upper middle class, the top 20% of wealth holders, off the hook. The wealth gap is important, but exclusionary zoning, restrictive college admission policies, and traditional ways of allocating internships also perpetuate inequality and make the American dream an elusive one for many. Richard Reeves is the author of Dream Hoarders: How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. Richard Reeves joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us here on 88.1 WIPR. You know, when the sweeping Republican tax bill was pushed through just before Christmas, critics noted that the majority of the benefits accrued to the wealthiest Americans, the top 1%. Wealth disparity is at record levels. The richest 1% of families controls nearly 40% of America's wealth. While wages for workers on the bottom of the spectrum have remained largely stagnant despite low unemployment. My guest today is Richard Reeves. He's a scholar at the Brookings Institution. He says that the gap that poses the greatest threat to our culture isn't the one between the really rich and the rest of us, but rather it's the gap between most people and the so-called upper middle class, the top 20% of Americans by wealth. That gap, he says, is changing how families are structured, it's informing our political and personal attitudes about everything, and it's perpetuating inequality. Mr. Reeves is the author of a book called Dream Hoarders: How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. He joins me on the line from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Mr. Reeves, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
So let's start first with the tax bill. You're not a fan. You wrote about this last month in The Guardian. You know, when you look at what's going on, I mean, our unemployment rate in America, just over 4% at an almost record low for the last 17, 20 years. The stock market is over 25,000. A lot of folks even who have manufacturing jobs or what people would consider working class jobs have pensions that are invested in the market. Here in Maryland, it was just announced that the electric company, Baltimore Gas and Electric, is going to lower rates for ratepayers because of the corporate gifts or benefits that they're going to get through this tax overhaul. What's not to like?
Well, there's a long list of things not to like, but that's not the same thing as saying that everything in the bill is bad. And I think what you've just illustrated is that you will expect to see some positive effects. For example, from a cut in the corporate tax rate, you would hope that that would result in lower prices for consumers and possibly a small increase in wages for workers. But the question is whether that was really the place to spend $1 trillion in terms of the challenges that are facing the country. What's the balance to be struck? And so the main problem, I think, with the tax bill is its distributional consequences on the personal tax side, which is predominantly to give significant tax cuts to those at the top of the distribution. As you said, the top 1%, partly because of the reduction in the estate tax and the cut in the top income tax rate, but also kind of a broader group than that, the top 10, 20% actually seeing some benefits from the tax bill too. And given that we've seen this increase in inequality, a tax bill which seems to accentuate that inequality just points the wrong way. For a long time, actually, we've been running to stand still in terms of inequality. In other words, we've been trying to use the tax system through things like the earned income tax credit and so on to try and help, you know, middle class and working class families. The tax bill goes in the other direction. And to that extent, it sort of just pours fuel on the fire of what is already a significant inequality problem.
What's wrong with inequality? What's bad about a wealth gap? Aren't there always going to be really rich people and really poor people, and then a bunch of people at various points on the spectrum in between? Isn't that always going to be the case at any point in history?
Sure. So you're always going to see inequality, and that's why I focus in my work a bit more on issues of class than than inequality, it's partly because, you know, my background is actually from the UK, where we know quite a bit about class, as anybody who's watched The Crown or Downton Abbey will know. But it's also because that idea of class or stratification gets at a kind of more enduring kind of inequality. It's not just like today's inequality. So the wealth gap today will be massively determined by how the stock market has done over the last 12 months, for example, and it'll go up and down and so on. What really I think should trouble us is when you see inequality being passed on from one generation to the next. In other words, knowing a lot about whether poor kids are going to stay poor and rich kids are going to stay rich. And when it starts to separate our society, you actually used the word, Tom, culture at the beginning. And I think you used it in the sense of if we see a separation of neighborhoods, a separation of schools, a huge separation of our college system by class, then what you're seeing is not just inequality, but enduring, perpetuating inequality and effectively a class society where your fate and your destiny are strongly determined by where you come from. And that's I think, a really big challenge, the idea of the American dream. So it's not inequality in and of itself at any moment in time. It's what that inequality means for the opportunities of the next generation. It's the inheritance of inequality that troubles me.
And you talk about it, you cite a work of a scholar named David Grusky saying that the increase in inequality over the past 30 or 40 years has happened all at the top, so that the bottom 80% of the population has not had that much of an increase in inequality. So the fact that it's concentrated at the very top, and what's the economic impact of that? I mean, when people say a strong middle class and a healthy, vibrant, and a wealthier middle class is necessary for economic growth, is that a, you know, just a sort of hands down accepted maxim of economics? Can we have growth, the kind of growth that the Republicans are suggesting we're going to get, if there is this much inequality between the top and the bottom?
Well, that's a very contested question, Tom. You've gone right to the heart of one of the hottest debates in economics, actually, which is can you show that at certain levels inequality is bad for growth? And the short and honest answer is no, you can't show that with any sort of clear, even people on the sort of left of the political spectrum would agree. I think there's no straight line between inequality and lack of economic growth. I'd actually turn the question slightly on its head, though, and say, look, what is economic growth for? Why are we so in favor of economic growth? And I think the reason why most people are in favor of it is because they think it'll make people's lives better. And they think that that'll make most people's lives better, as it did for a generation after World War II. But if you have lots, if you have even decent economic growth, but almost all of that growth is being captured by the people at the top and by the owners of capital, and not much of the value of that growth is going to the middle or even to the bottom 80%, frankly, then you might start to question what kind of growth you want. And so I think that's why we're hearing people talk about inclusive growth or more equal growth. And so it's the nature of the growth that's the problem. And right now, the proceeds of growth are accruing to those at the top. And as you said at the beginning, especially to those at the very top. But I would argue that to those who've got decent education and in this kind of top 20 or so percent, the upper middle class, who actually over the last 30 years have done okay. You're right, you quote Grusky, and others would, I think, agree. There has been no increase in inequality in the bottom 80% of the distribution. All the action is above that line, and the higher you go, the more action there is. And so if someone says there's a growing gap between rich and poor, that's not quite right empirically. There's a growing gap between the rich, the 20% or higher, and everybody else. That's the nature of inequality.
And by upper middle class, because you've got upper middle class right in the title of the book, how the upper middle class is leaving everyone else in the dust, why that's a problem and what to do about it. What do you mean by the upper middle class? Give us the parameters. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I end up defining it economically. I actually struggled with this. I started off by looking at how people define themselves, but it turns out that everybody in America defines themselves as middle class, 90% or so, which is why, as you said, every politician's in favor of a strong middle class. But a number of people will then agree that they're upper middle class, about 15%, 16% or so. But really, my identification of the top 20%, and that's, to be clear, households with incomes now of about above 125,000, maybe 130,000 today, that sort of number, anything above that line, and the average income for that top 20% is about $200,000 per household. So that's the kind of people we're talking about. They're predominantly college educated, predominantly in management or professions. And they're the group who have seen an income gain over the last 20, 30 years. And actually, they've seen much more of a cumulative income gain than the whole of the 80% put together. And so it's really where that seems to be the point in the economic distribution where people have done better over the last 20 or 30 years. That's where the inequality problem begins, at about that kind of income level. Below that, the income distribution looks about the same as it did 20 or 30 years ago in terms of the gap.
And you also talk about how this upper middle class quintile, and first of all, you identify yourself as part of that. Mm-hmm. I would probably identify myself as part of that, although I used to have more employment than I currently have, and so I'm making actually substantially less money than I was making 2 years ago, so I may be somewhere on the cusp. But you talk about how the upper middle class has sort of become the enemy. I mean, you mentioned the 25-30% of voters who support Mr. Trump and supported him during the campaign, they had no trouble with the super wealthy. They had no trouble with the rich. It was the journalists, the medical professionals, the people in media, the people who, as you say, these professionals in the upper middle class that they really took exception with as a political matter.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there I would sort of point to the work of scholars like Joan Williams and Arlie Hochschild, who I think have really done good work in this space. And it does look as if many of the people who voted for Trump actually, they're kind of pro the rich and they're kind of wealthy. I mean, Trump himself, after all, is rich. And it does seem to be more of a kind of anti-upper middle class, anti-professional kind of move. It's this sense of almost kind of an anti-expertise, the people who think that they know, the people who appear on radio stations talking like this, the people who control almost every institution, whether it's a college, a community college, a newspaper, a local radio station, a school, etc., the people who've got college degrees and basically run everything. And there's a bit of a reaction against them, I think. And it might be partly because people see that group as doing pretty well, and how well they're doing varies by place and by individual. But, you know, by and large, they are managing to put something away for their retirement. By and large, they are able to afford to send their kids to college. They can own their own home. And their incomes do not seem to have been sliding backwards or standing still. And so to the extent that there's some class anger mixed in with everything else that was mixed into the election last year, I think there's a little bit of that reaction against this white-collar, professional, upper-middle-class group that, as you say, I certainly inhabit and most of the people who I know inhabit.
Mm-hmm. And let's assume that I inhabit it as well, so I'll use the term we when I talk about the upper-middle class. You talk about our political clout. For one, we are assiduous voters, you write. We vote at rates approaching 80%. That's much higher than the national average.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's right. So there's that kind of direct political power. And, of course, that's a good thing that people vote. We want more people to vote. But it's also the other kinds of power that we exercise through institutions, through the kind of control we have of, you know, pretty much the entire education system, media, et cetera. And what I think that, and, of course, almost the entire political system. So what that means, for example, is you'll see Congress obsessing about the cost of, you know, expensive four-year colleges or postgraduate degrees and so on, because that's the world that most people in Congress and those who are in think tanks and lobby groups around them inhabit. Their kids do go to four-year colleges. They do worry about the cost of postgraduate education, but they barely ever talk about community colleges, which is where most kids from middle class and low-income backgrounds go. And so you see it just reflected in our political discourse is that there's a bit of a bubble here, and we're in that bubble and we're contributing to that bubble. And that, I think, has created a bit of a sense of mismatch here. And one of the reasons why I strongly argue against it just being the top 1%, I think obviously there's a top 1% problem, is that we are the 99% sign. I actually just saw one walking here and saw another still up, we are the 99%. I think it's a profoundly unhelpful political slogan, because what it does is it allows people with incomes reaching well up to $400,000 a year household income, let alone the 200, and convince themselves that they're not rich. It's those people above them who are rich, and that they're not part of the inequality problem. And that's a very comforting thought for us, to sort of think, well, it's not my fault. It's all those people making the really big bucks who are the problem. But that's not where the real class fracture that we should worry about in our schools and colleges and neighborhoods and communities is. And it's not the one that we should be. We should look in the mirror as well as looking at everybody else.
Well, we are going to take a little break, and we will come back and do some mirror gazing on that very subject. I'm fascinated by this book. I'm fascinated by your thesis, where you talk about it's not just the money, but it's the advantages that accrue to people who live in certain neighborhoods, people who can control their working life, people who can control the quality of the neighborhoods they live in, planning for the future. I mean, these are all things, even health and diet, all that kind of stuff that plays into having a comfortable comfortable life. And I want to talk about how these opportunities are, according to your thesis, being hoarded by the upper middle class. Richard Reeves is my guest. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington and the co-director of the Brookings Center on Children and Families. His book is called Dream Hoarders: How the Upper American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. You can join our conversation. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @Midday. Tom Hall, stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we'll preview the upcoming session of the Maryland General Assembly with two reporters who keep a very close eye on all things Annapolis. Rachel Bay from WYPR and the Baltimore Sun's Aaron Cox will join me. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. The General Assembly reconvenes on Wednesday. If you're just joining us today, Richard Reeves is my guest. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington and the co-director of the Brookings Center on Children and Families. His book is called Dream Hoarders: How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Richard Reeves, you remind us in your book about a particular tax incentive, a tax sheltering program that was introduced by George W. Bush in 2001 called the 529 plan. So anybody who has put a kid through college or who is in the process of trying to do that is well aware of that. You remind us that when the Republicans proposed something like that during the Clinton administration, he promptly vetoed it. Democrats were not on board with that kind of thing, at least in the early years of the late 90s. But Barack Obama continued it. When he even suggested that it be discontinued, people jumped all over him. Explain for folks who may not be familiar with it what a 529 plan does and why that is something, in your opinion, that just simply advantages certain people over others.
Well, it's back in the news again, of course, because it's in the Republican tax bill, so perhaps we'll say a bit about that. But 529 plans are a way that you can save for your kids' college and not pay any capital gains tax when you take the money out at the other end, as long as you use it for educational purposes. And the reason why Clinton vetoed it was because he realized, as did most Democrats at the time, that the only people who would be able to afford to save enough money to get a real capital gain were people who are affluent. And so that it would effectively be a tax break for affluent Americans. And that's exactly how it's turned out. Almost all the value of 529 plans goes to people like myself who are in a position to save for our kids' education and get the capital gain at the end of it. It's also exempt from gift tax. So Barack Obama himself and his wife put in $250,000 in 1 year for their daughter's education, and they were very open about that, which means that, of course, you can get really quite big capital gains then. So the people who are able to put a lot of money into these are able to get big capital gains. Then states, including Maryland, will then give you a state income tax deduction on it. So in Maryland, a married couple with two kids like myself, you can save up to $10,000 a year into those 529s and set that against your Maryland income tax, which gives you a tax break on your Maryland income tax. And again, almost all the benefit goes to those who are more affluent. So, you know, this, at the moment, we're only talking about a few billion a year, although it is going to rise over time. And it's essentially just a straightforward tax break to those who are in the group I write about, the upper middle class, who are able to save and who are worried about getting their kids to college. And so it's one of the classic unintended consequence in a way, or I don't know how unintended it was, but it sounds great. Give a tax break to let people pay for their kids' education. But the way it's designed, because of capital gains, is that almost all the benefit goes to those in the top quintile. Now, the Republicans, the latest tax bill, have allowed a new use of 529 plans, which is not just for post-secondary education, not just for college, but for private K-12 education as well. And I think that's going to mean there's going to be a big increase in the take-up of these plans. And if the states keep the income tax deduction like Maryland, then I think we're going to see a really big increase in the amount of money going into these plans, again, from the people who are already doing quite well. So in terms of where you're going to spend your money, in terms of who you think needs the most help, helping people like me save for my kids' education is really not the top priority of the U.S. government.
But of course, folks would say the top 20% are paying most of the taxes. So for them to get a break that people in the lower quintiles don't get is fundamentally fair. So even if you're making minimum wage and you're living paycheck to paycheck and you don't have like the Obamas, you know, $250,000 to throw in for your kids' education in some money market or some stock fund, that the reason is that you're paying taxes on the other end at a higher rate. And even with the tax bill that we have in front of us now, the rates for high earners are higher than they are for low earners.
Yes, so it's a fact that the people who have more money pay more tax. That's the way the tax system does and should work. But it seems to me, just in terms of efficiency, even if we take out the fairness aspect of it, that to take money from me and then say, oh, we've taken a lot of money from him, let's give him some of it back in the form of this very complex deduction, is a little bit of a strange way to go around it. If you really think that I shouldn't be paying as much tax, well, just cut my tax rate, which, of course, the Republicans just did. But instead of all these deductions, and of course, the big one is the mortgage interest deduction, which go to sort of subsidize various kinds of activity. And what that means, it means this tax system is much more complex than it should be. But it adds a regressive element to the system. So that argument is made. Well, they're paying a lot of tax, so let's give them some of it back. But that's not a very good policy argument, because that makes for a very complex and inefficient system. It seems to me that if you don't believe, even Republicans should agree, if they're not that keen on the government, that it's not a great use of government time and money to take money off people only in order to turn around and give it back to them through a complex deduction.
So would you then assert that, for example, the mortgage interest deduction, which at least in this plan has been capped, heretofore wasn't capped, but now it's capped, the mortgage interest deduction or a 529 plan, should they be just completely done away with, taken off the books, and simply we should not be using the tax code to incentivize home ownership or to incentivize saving for college? We should somehow do that. We should make those incentives happen through other means.
Well, there's a prior question, which is the extent to which it's the government's job to be incentivizing those behaviors anyway. Is it the government's job to incentivize home ownership, for example, as opposed to renting? You know, most countries now have moved away from that. The country I come from, the UK, did have a mortgage interest deduction and got rid of it on a bipartisan basis. It was phased out over a 10-year period because it distorts the housing market. Anytime the government subsidizes a market, then it distorts that market. The problem with the mortgage interest deduction, a bit like 529s, is it doesn't do very much to encourage home ownership at the margin. In other words, it doesn't do very much to help someone who wouldn't otherwise buy a house to buy a house, because the value of the deduction for them is quite small, because they're probably relatively modest incomes and buying a relatively modestly priced house. What it does do is increase the depth of home ownership. Almost all of the value of the mortgage interest deduction goes to upper middle class families. Why? Because they buy very expensive houses. And so if you buy a $1 million house and you've up until now been able to claim all of the interest on that as a deduction, then all it's done really is to encourage people to buy more expensive houses than they would have otherwise done, and probably to inflate the housing market a bit at the top. So it's regressive and distortionary. And yes, it should go. I'm not saying it should go overnight, but let's say it could be phased out over time, then I think that would make for a better and a fairer housing market. And it would mean that the government wasn't spending between $50 and $70 billion a year helping me to own my house.
You're right that education has become the main mechanism for the reproduction of upper middle class status across generations. So if you're born in a comfortable house, chances are very good that you'll end up as an adult in a comfortable house, and your children will be similarly comfortable. About a third of adult Americans have a college degree, so it's certainly a pretty small subset of the general population. But you write that the 6 out of 10 25-year-olds raised in top-income families get a bachelor's degree. I wonder, and a couple of other people have noted this as well, if the gap is so important, if the accrual of all these benefits to being in the upper middle class is so acute, wouldn't it be higher than 6 out of 10?
Well, I think it is actually getting higher. So those numbers, every time you look at them, they tend to go up. So I think we're nudging up towards closer to 7 in 10. But but you're right. You might expect it would be closer to 90%. That might sometimes reflect the bubble that we're in within a bubble, if you like, because I suspect that many of us, you and I, and perhaps some people listening to, are quite highly educated ourselves. We're from college-educated backgrounds. And so even within the upper middle class, we'd probably put a premium on college education. So we may even have a sort of sense of distortion as to how important it is for our own kids. But that number is going up. And more importantly, the segregation by type of college is really increasing too. And so let's say it's now 7, and there's a gender gap here too, of course, but let's say it's now 7 in 10 or whatever. If you turn it this other way around, if you take the Ivy League and elite colleges, 70% of their students are from upper middle class backgrounds. And so they are predominantly upper middle class institutions now. And that, if anything, is getting slightly more concentrated over time. And so you're seeing this kind of real separation in the kind of institutions you go to. Meanwhile, the only institutions that have seen an increase in the number of poor kids from the bottom 20% going to college are for-profit colleges. And so if you want to see the U.S. class system illuminated, look at the post-secondary system, look at college. I think in other countries, you might, like the U.K., might want to look at secondary education, but the class system really gets illuminated in a very bright light when you hit 18, 19, 20. Because whether you go to college, and if so, what kind of college you go to, and whether you finish college, that the background that you come from hugely determines that. And then, as you said at the beginning, Tom, that then reproduces status across generations. It's the main way in which upper-middle-class parents ensure that their kids get upper-middle-class status is by doing pretty much anything to get them a college degree, including defending their 529 plans, which we just talked about. And it was Liberal Democrats who killed Barack Obama's idea on the 529s because their constituents were very angry about the fact that it was being taken away from them. They'd come to see it as an entitlement, partly because of their own concern about their kids' education.
Richard Rees is my guest. We're talking about dream hoarding. His book is called Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Richard, we have an email from a listener, Pamela, in Baltimore, who talks about this bubble within a bubble that you've just alluded to. She says, I'm among the affluent 20% and have one teenager. I'm blessed to have a wonderful group of parent friends who have a sense of reason, balance, and common sense in their parenting philosophies. However, there is a subset among the affluent 20%, mostly in Washington and New York, who have very different attitudes, and their philosophy has to be seen as part of the hoarding problem as well. In their hearts, this subset of the 20% believes that the only real indice of their child's or their own success is admission to a top-tier university. And I think that much of the hoarding that Rees describes has this genesis. The damage done by dream hoarders isn't just to the non-affluent, but to their own children. You write a lot about college admission policies, particularly in the Ivy League, the legacy dimension of getting into places like Harvard or Yale or Princeton. If the best students are from the upper middle class because they are, for a variety of reasons, going to the best schools as high school kids and elementary school kids, wouldn't you want them to have the opportunity to attend the best colleges?
Well, I don't want to take opportunities away from anybody. I just want a fairer allocation of those opportunities. But I think Pamela's point is right. And you do see almost a kind of desperation among some members of the upper middle class, perhaps those especially towards the top, where really it seems as if kind of getting into a college which is just ever so slightly more wonderful than the other college is worth any amount of money and effort. But then I think what we have to do is try to understand that desperation. And I think it's for two reasons. One, they've realized how important education is in the labor market, and they're right about that, although they may be overemphasizing the specific institution. And two, because because college admissions has become quite competitive and quite selective, and because they don't want their kids to be downwardly mobile. One of the results of growing inequality and the separation of this group at the top from everybody else is that it looks like quite a painful drop. And so actually looking at the more we have radio stories and Brookings reports saying how badly the middle class are doing, which is true, the more that those of us who are at the top are going to be determined to make sure our kids don't end up in that place. And so inequality itself changes the incentives, and it creates the kind of desperation I think Pamela is referring to. And so it does require everyone to take a bit of a deep breath and relax a little bit. But also, the U.S. college admissions process is opaque, expensive, and quite unfair. Legacy admissions is just the tip of the iceberg, and in and of itself, I would have thought just outrageous to any right-thinking American. I'm American now, and to have a hereditary principle operating in college admissions strikes me as really deeply un-American.
But yeah, it's not you and a lot that. Of people. Yeah.
I mean, not just that though, but you know, how many colleges do you have to apply to? Have you expressed an interest? Early admissions. You know, the opacity of the system. Half the time you don't know how people got in. The fact that if parents donate, that seems to help their kids get in. It's a hot mess, candidly, to use a non-technical term. And the more complex and opaque it is, the better that is for the upper middle class, because they can navigate that complexity. They know people and they know how the system works. They can game the system. And so just simplifying it and making it just straightforwardly more meritocratic would be a big step forward. And then we could go further and perhaps have more affirmative action for kids from poor backgrounds.
Yeah, you do mention that away from the idea of selectivity and these legacy admissions and that kind of stuff, there are ways of making it more meritocratic, getting into college, one of which is to do a better job of matching high-ability poor kids to better colleges. Give us a couple of other examples of things that could be done into the current college admission system that would allocate the resources more fairly and lead to more and better diversity in these colleges, but from top to bottom on the spectrum.
Well, it'd be fantastic if the admissions process could be more centralized and simplified, and colleges have made various attempts to do that through the Common App and so on, but that's never really succeeded, and so you have to make multiple admissions. I think the simplifying the financial aid form would hugely help. I think reducing, getting rid of or reducing the value of things like have you visited the college as a factor, and early admissions, getting rid of early admissions, which favors those who are from more affluent backgrounds and so on, as well as, of course, sweeping away legacies. Those things would all help to simplify the system and streamline it. I think it would be a more radical suggestion, which I don't think I get as far as this in the book, is to say, look, if we know what sort of level then you need to get in your SATs or whatever to get into a certain college, and you have way more people who have that score applying, maybe you take some of them from the very top of that distribution, but why not do the rest by lottery? Why not just draw the rest of it out of a hat? Because that would seem to me to probably generate fairer outcomes than what we've currently got. And some high schools have experimented with that idea, as you know, and of course charter schools will use lotteries and so on. Because we do know that some of these elite universities and colleges will let people in with lower grades. It just depends on who their parents were and whether they're legacies and so on. Or if they're athletes sometimes. So maybe we should just set a bar and then do the rest by law.
You also say that free college is a terrible idea. This is an idea adduced by Senator Sanders when he was running for president last year. I heard Joe Biden speak in support of it just a few days ago. Why is that such a rotten idea?
Well, it's because of the way things are currently constituted in terms of who goes to college. So I'd probably say it a little bit more carefully now, actually, because the reason why I think it's a terrible idea is because right now, college is dominated, and especially the more expensive colleges, and including publics where it apply, of course, by those from the upper middle class. And so what you will end up with the situation is that almost all the benefit of free college will go to kids from more affluent backgrounds. That's what happened in the UK when we had free college and why we kind of moved away from it. It turned out to be a very regressive system. So if we had a situation where we had much more mix, economic as well as other kinds of diversity in the people going to the expensive colleges, then I think I would be more relaxed about the idea of making it free and a public good. But right now, it would have a deeply regressive effect in terms of who would actually get that benefit. And so we need to make the system way more equal before we can make it free. Otherwise, it will be deeply regressive.
Speaking of college, we've just heard from a representative at Johns Hopkins University that Johns Hopkins will be closing at 1 o'clock today because of the icy weather that's predicted for this afternoon. I do not have, by any means, a complete list of closures that are predicted for this afternoon. You can come to our website, WYPR.org, to get an update on that. But if you are a Hopkins student or a professor headed to class this afternoon, you have the afternoon off. Richard Reeves is my guest. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington and the author of the book Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. When we come back from a break, you can join our conversation. Chris from Patterson Park will be first up when we do return from a break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 16 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which they've been keeping since 2007. Already, five people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence in this new year. During the weekend that ended last Friday, January 5th, four people were victims of homicide. They included two men who have yet to be identified by police, as well as Brian Taylor, who was age 30, and Andre Galloway. He was only 16 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Richard Reeves. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution over in D.C. and the author of Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. Mr. Reeves is also a contributor to The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times, among other publications. Last September, Politico named him one of the top 50 thinkers in the United States for his work on class and inequality. We're talking about the threat to our culture posed by the gap between most Americans and the so-called upper middle class, the top 20% of Americans by wealth. You can join that conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle at midday Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Chris in Patterson Park, welcome to Midday with Richard Reeves.
Thanks for taking my call. I look forward to reading your book, Mr. Reeves. It's fascinating. My question from like a 10,000-foot view is, in light of this coming wave of automation that apparently is predicted to automate literally tens of thousands of hardworking Americans out of their jobs, particularly in those lower rungs, my question, how is this expected to exacerbate things for them, and will it result in class warfare, do you see a dystopic future based on where we are right now and a lot of what you're talking about, or do you think there's still time to kind of see our way out of this and help society? That's my question.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Chris. Appreciate it.
It's a great question, Chris. Thank you. And a lot of people are thinking about it because I think you've really put your finger on one of the biggest worries we have right now in terms of our long-term political economy. And some people think that we're over-worrying, that every time there's a technological advance, everyone panics, and then we adjust and we're fine again. Or is it different this time? And I think there's a reason to think it could be different this time. And the dystopian future that you mentioned was actually described by Michael Young in his book, Meritocracy, where he made up the word. He actually thought a meritocracy would be defined by a place where clever people made machines and other people had almost nothing to do. Kurt Vonnegut did the same thing. And I think it's a real test, actually, because, first of all, we'll need to help those who are displaced in the same way that we should have done more to help those displaced by trade, by automation, and get people ready. And so are we willing to make the investments in retraining and in education, which politicians are fond of talking about, but actually we underinvest in? And also, and I think this is a more difficult one, Chris, how far we allow automation to affect upper middle class jobs, or how effectively the upper middle class professions defend themselves against that. Because one of the new things this time actually is that with things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, actually quite a lot of the things that were done by the upper middle class in, for example, the legal profession or the medical profession will actually be quite strongly challenged. And I think what we'll see is how good the upper middle class are defending themselves against this. You already know probably that radiology is done better very often by AI than it is by doctors. There's an argument that lots of the stuff that's done by lawyers, poring over case law and so on, is AI is really going to affect all that too. But actually the upper middle class have proved through things like occupational licensing and lobbying to be quite successful at making sure they don't face the same sort of pressures that others do. You know, their doctors are not being Ubered out of a job yet. But AI could mean that they are. And so actually how the automation affects different classes is a good test of whether or not my fear is justified that the upper middle class will continue to protect themselves at all costs, even if that means leaving a lot of other people behind as AI and the robots take their jobs.
Well, I got to tell you, Mr. Reeves, I found this book really, really compelling in so many ways. And part of the part that I perhaps found the most compelling was your discussion of what you call meritocracy without mobility. And I was intrigued by this. You suggest that in a nation that supposedly prides itself on meritocracy, we should have better intergenerational mobility when it comes to income and wealth and education. The rates that we currently have are lower than they ought to be if we were truly a meritocratic society. You gave an example of fund managers from in the financial business. Fund managers from poor backgrounds perform better than the fund managers who come from affluent backgrounds. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I think when you think about it, it sort of makes sense because they probably had to overcome more obstacles and so on to get to where they are. But I bet you when a lot of us are choosing our financial advisor or whoever, we might well go for the person who seems to come from a good background, who has got polished manners and a nice suit and all that. But we'd be better off getting the person who's actually got a background that's a much more working class background. Maybe it's a bit rougher around the edges because actually the chances are they'll do better. But there's a broader point there too, which is that if we define merit just in market terms, the market actually does sort of reward even those fund managers you just mentioned. The problem is that if we define merit just in terms of your ability to flourish in the labor market because of your education and skills, then what we do is we build in an advantage to those who had the chance to develop those education and skills. A deep meritocracy as opposed to a shallow one, a real equality of opportunity meritocracy, if you like, is one not only where you get a chance to perform well in the market, where you get to compete, but it's where you get a chance to prepare for the competition through education and skills. And the gap that you've just referred to at the beginning about education, neighborhoods, family structure, etc., mean that our kids from the upper middle class enter the labor market pretty capable. And so amazing, you know, unsurprisingly, they do well. So the unfairness has taken place before work in the first 25 years of life rather than in the market itself.
Richard Reeves is my guest. His book is called Dream Hoarders. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, it's @MiddayTomHall. You make the point that, as you said, that meritocracy is not synonymous with fairness. I was also intrigued by a scholar that you quote, Yuval Levin, who is a conservative by your description. Levin asserts that the biggest problem is not inequality, but immobility, that we should be having more people you know, basically the rags to riches stories that we like to hear about in America should be stories that we're telling about more people. Is that at the root of what this is about? And if that's the case, is then it also the case that it'd be better to have a bigger upper middle class, that we should have more people in it?
In the upper middle class, if you define it the way I do here as the top 20%, then it can't get bigger. You can only ever have a fifth of the population in it. And one of the things that people don't like to say is that if you want more people moving into that top 20%, then you need more people moving out and making room for them. You do need downward mobility to have that kind of upward mobility. But the broad point, I think, is right, is that we want everyone to be doing better. We want everyone to be proceeding. Where I disagree with Yuval Levin, who is a conservative, but he's a reformicon, I think, you know, one of those reform conservatives, is that he doesn't think that inequality, in the way that I define it, in income, wealth, education, housing, everything, is affecting mobility. Whereas I think it is deeply affecting mobility. So I think that the conservatives like Yuval Levin are wrong to think that you can separate the goal of greater mobility from the goal of more equality. Not really, I think, Tom, as you've hinted at, just in terms of income, but perhaps even more importantly in terms of education, neighborhood, housing. We're seeing even in the last few days the Trump administration moving away from some of the Fair Housing Acts that Barack Obama was kind of pushing. And so just the segregation economically of our neighborhoods, the segregation economically of our institutions means that we're an increasingly separated, class-bound society.
Carla in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Richard Reeves. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm glad to hear you. Have you looked at the contribution of historically black colleges and universities in terms of equalizing some of the gaps? Because as African Americans, a lot of us prior, you know, there was a time when we weren't accepted in some of the majority universities, and now more and more I notice African-American youth are choosing or selecting into the HBCU because of the trauma that they've had to deal with in terms of dealing with majority institutions. And then I also want to also ask a quick question about, you know, the value of vocational education, which has been taken out of the case. Most schools need to be put back in there.
Okay, thanks, Carly. You're cracking up a little bit, but Richard Reeves, you do write about vocational education, but the important role of HBCUs in boosting African-American mobility.
Yes, well, I have actually looked at that using data from the Equality of Opportunity Project led by a scholar called Raj Chetty, and actually have produced a little bit of data on this. And actually, historically, black colleges are very good news for upward social mobility. And the reason they're such good news is actually not because the performance of students from them is so much better than from other colleges. It's because they attract so many low-income students. And they attract black students who from low-income backgrounds who might not otherwise have gone to college. And so simply because they're such magnets for black students, particularly black students from low-income backgrounds, they end up doing really very important work in terms of promoting upward mobility. So I'm glad Carla asked that question, because honestly, I'm not sure I would have known if that was the case until we had the data that they are doing such a good job. And in terms of vocational education, again, I think she's right. There's a real problem in the US in particular, which is that the college, obsession with college, which we've talked about a lot, has actually meant that the vocational education, associate's degrees, certificates, apprenticeships in particular, have tended to be underfunded, underinvested in, largely ignored. And if we're being candid, they're always seen as something for other people's kids. And they're a little bit stigmatized as being for the kids who just weren't quite smart enough. And the problem with that is there's lots of kids who are smart enough to go to college who aren't. But also, quality vocational education leading to kind of, you know, well-paid jobs should not be stigmatized. Actually, that's something we should be massively investing in. And so actually, there's a real deep cultural issue here around making sure that other kinds of education, as well as college education, are properly validated and recognized. And that, Tom, will only happen when more kids from the upper middle class are pursuing those options too. Right now, they're seen as what you do if you fail at everything else. And as long as that's the case, then they won't get the attention that they deserve, because in the future, high quality modern vocational education is critical.
We're down to our last couple of minutes. You do talk about solutions to this problem, and you contend that what the upper middle class would have to give up or sacrifice is not all that substantial. We have a caller from Stevensville, Lee, on the line, who I think has a question in that regard. Lee, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I have a new grandson. We're in the upper middle class, and we have a grandson. We're thinking about the 529 plan for his college education, but I've read your book, and I'm very sympathetic to what you talk about, and I feel like if we do this 529 plan, are we contributing to all of the issues that you bring up in the book? Because I'm embarrassed to do this if I'm contributing to these issues. But
yeah, thanks for the call, Lee. You want to help your kids and your grandkids, but no, Richard Reeves, how do you avoid hoarding if you happen to be part of the upper middle class?
It's a great question, Lee, and thank you for doing that and allowing us to be personal, because this stuff gets personal. And I really appreciate the fact that you're being thoughtful and intentional about it. That's the most I can hope for. Here's what I do, Lee. I have 529 plans for my kids in Maryland. I have two kids in Maryland married. And what I do is I calculate exactly what the value of that 529 deduction is to me this year in terms of Maryland. And I give all that money to a charity in D.C. that works to help low-income kids to get into college. So I do save, but I don't take any economic value from it. I calculate to the dollar what it is. It's a standing joke now with the guy I give the money to. So look, we want to do the best for our kids, but let's try and do the best for other people's kids too. So that's my solution, Lee. I don't know what yours will be, but the fact that you're thinking about it is terrific.
Well, you have proposed many provocative thoughts in this book. It's a terrific read. And Richard Reeves, I appreciate your time and the contributions you've made with this book. Thanks so much.
Thanks to you and to the questioners.
Richard Reeves is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. The book is called Dream Hoarders, How the American Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. We've got more information about the book, and we've even got a link to an online quiz that you can take to see if you are, in fact, a dream hoarder. Come to WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a preview of the upcoming session of the Maryland General Assembly. Annapolis reporters Rachel Bay from WIPR and Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun will join me. The session begins on Wednesday. We'll give it a preview tomorrow. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.